This is episode 14 of IDRA Class Notes.
Nothing good can come from a social, political, or educational system that requires self-rejection as a condition for participation.
Welcome to IDRA's Class Notes podcast. I am Dr. Bradley Scott. Now, if you're a regular listener, I really want to thank you for coming back today. And if you're a first-time listener, this podcast is for people who care about making sure that every child has an excellent and equitable education. The Intercultural Development Research Association is deeply committed to making schools work for all children. And to do that, we value what the language and the culture that children and families bring. I have said to you any number of times that we are a small organization with a very big mission. Now, during the course of this podcast, if you hear something that strikes your attention in a particular kind of way or that brings a question to your mind, we would really love to hear from you. There will be details at the end of the podcast for where you can send an email or fill out our comment online. And I also encourage you to subscribe to this podcast either through our website or iTunes and other podcast directories so you won't miss a single episode. We have posted our website, by the way, and have posted on our website a very short survey. I am making a personal appeal to you that you spend just a few moments and go to our website and fill out that survey. The results will help us to serve you better, and we would really appreciate hearing from you. It won't take long. We've made sure that it won't take long, but that it will get to some important information that we need from you. So if you do fill out the survey, you will have a chance for a drawing for an Amazon gift certificate. And by the way, we'll be running this survey through the end of June or longer if necessary. So I encourage you to go to our website and spend just a moment or two filling out that survey. Well, let me tell you, today we have back with us Josie Denini-Cortez. We have, in fact, had Josie on before. She is a great, great researcher. And you may remember that she was with us before talking about research that she oversaw around early childhood education through our Project READ. I've asked Josie to come back today because of work she has done in another very important area. And by the way, the first time that we're talking about this area, we're going to be looking at good schools for children learning English. And this will focus on the area or the issue of bilingual education, a topic that we haven't actually spent time discussing, but that we have alluded to with relationship to some of the other topics that we have had in this podcast series. Now, as you may remember, Josie is a veteran researcher who continues to lead many of IDRA's key research efforts. She is, by the way, a former director of IDRA's Division for Research and Evaluation. But in addition to that, or in that capacity, she has led a national research study on exemplary bilingual education programs. She certainly has involved in the dropout research and participated in efforts in the dropout research that IDRA has, in fact, conducted in many other areas. By the way, Ms. Cortez is a medical anthropologist and has been an adjunct faculty member at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio School of Medicine for 25 years. She received her bachelor's degree in anthropology from the University of Notre Dame and received her master's degree in medical anthropology from Case Western Reserve University. So Josie, listen, I just want to say welcome back, and it's great to have you with us again today, talking about what I think is a very important topic for this day and age and what we're trying to do in terms of ensuring that no child is left behind. In this instance, children whose first language is other than English. And so I really want to thank you for taking some time out today to be with us to talk about the Good Schools study and rubric that was created and some of the research that we are aware of that involves bilingual education. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Bradley, and it's a delight to be here and to share some of the information that we've collected over the last few years with our audience.
So, Josie, let me just start off by asking you to do two things, one of which is to tell us about the Good School study and why there was a need for such a study.
Back in 2000, the U.S. Department of Education had commissioned IDRA to come up with some criteria that schools and practitioners could use to identify exemplary bilingual ed programs or promising practices in bilingual education. And IDRA, for about 2 years, did just that. We conducted research with a rigorous design, looking at exemplary programs in about 10 schools across the country, different contexts, different areas, everything from a reservation school to a Russian immigrant school to a large urban inner city school to a rural school. So we tried to run the gamut in terms of getting
a good
heterogeneous spread. So we could see if, in fact, there were any things across sites that emerged as trends, consistent indicators of excellence. And our bottom line in identifying an exemplary practice or an exemplary school program, the bottom line was, were children achieving? Were they meeting or exceeding state standards and national standards, for example? And the need for this was and continues to be huge. We have at this point in time a little over 4 million children in U.S. public schools who are English language learners, and that number has doubled over the past 10 years.
Amazing.
So it's imperative for schools to have guidance and to have real examples of what needs to happen in their schools to make sure that all of their children, but particularly ELLs, English language learners, do achieve. So in selecting schools, and by the way, we selected them with nominations and recommendations from state education agencies, from bilingual education directors, from Title I directors, at that time Title VII, now Title III directors. So we got a lot of people who have to work with schools in a capacity building way to give us some ideas of
who to contact. And some leads. Okay, that's great.
And as we contacted about 30, 40 schools, we asked them for their student data. That was the bottom line. And we disaggregated the data, we looked at the data to make sure that what we were seeing was in fact evidence of achievement for all of their students, but particularly for ELLs. Once they had passed that selection criterion, then the other one was, were they willing to participate? And by participate, I mean give us a lot more access to a lot of their data, as well as to allow us to go into their schools and formally observe the classrooms, interview the teachers, the parents, the students, families, administrators, central office, district administrators, a rather comprehensive research study to find out what it was that they were doing.
That created the student success.
Exactly. And 10 of them said, sure, come on in. So we got on planes, and IDRA staff talked to people, documented their observations, and they came back and we analyzed all of the data and found that, in fact, there were some commonalities across sites. And it was those commonalities that gave us criteria and standards and ended up being a rubric that we created from that research study that we could put in the hands of practitioners, of people who wanted to either improve their current program or start a program. By the way, the different programs that we looked at included dual language programs, transitional programs, late exit programs. So there was a mix as well of the types of programs. And I'll be happy to share with you some of the things that we found about that. One of the goals of the research, I should state at this point, was not to prove that bilingual education works. We know it works. It was a matter of finding out what works best for children in first and second language acquisition. And we're not the only ones that say it works. Of course, there's been a huge body of research that includes Kenji Hakuda's work, Krashen and McPhail's meta-analysis.
Sure.
And even as recent as 2006, the National Literacy Panel on Language Minority Children and Youth that cited that there was clear evidence that bilingual education is the best approach for English language learners to learn English. So the goal really was to give practitioners some very, very clear guidelines and examples of what works based on student achievement.
Sounds great. So, Josie, in this era, we're trying to make sure that third graders, under No Child Left Behind, third graders are ready to read in order to access the curriculum. You're still saying that bilingual education is important as a tool or a vehicle for a child whose first language is not English to learn English, to acquire that second language.
Our research study and our work for over 30 years continues to prove that that is the best way for children to learn English. And I might add something that previous IDRA member, Dr. Blandina Cárdenas, who in addition to serving on the U.S. Civil Rights Commission many years ago, as well as now is the president of the University of Texas at Pan American, something that she said still rings true, and that is that nothing good can come from a social, political, or educational system that requires self-rejection as a condition for participation.
That's a fabulous thought.
Children and their families should never have
to reject themselves
or their language or their culture or their beliefs or their values in order to participate in our public education system. If we believe that, and we do, then the alternative is to embrace what children and their families bring to the school, their language and their culture, and to see that as assets that children and families bring with them. If we take that premise to be true, then our instructional strategies, our curriculum, our leadership, everything that we do in a classroom then has to be about validating and valuing the child's language. And knowing that if a child doesn't have to reject his parents' language, then he probably will learn English a lot quicker. Children for forever have acted as intergenerational, cross-generational translators. We've done it for our parents may have done it for our grandparents, and now we see them as intergenerational and cross-generational translators trying to cross the digital divide.
Absolutely.
So in trying to help parents get on the internet, our children often sometimes are born with a little mouse in their hands and have absolutely no problem in getting onto a computer and helping us surf the net or find resources on the net. It's the same thing. We don't devalue that capacity and that asset to be technology savvy. Why would we diminish children who know another language or know a language and have to tell them you have to stop using that language to learn this other language? It doesn't happen in Europe or most of the other countries in the world. It is expected that children will not only be bilingual but often trilingual, because you are a citizen of the world.
Absolutely.
So absolutely, you have to learn English, but never, never should it be at the expense of your first language.
Well, both you and Bambi Cardenas make an excellent point. Josie, I'm excited to hear some of the things that we found out in terms of these programs, and I know our time is running short, and I don't want to rush you, but I do want to give you some time to talk about some of what we learned across these 10 programs that are very different, and in terms of what makes for quality bilingual education.
What we found, Bradley, were that there are essentially five dimensions that we identified that needed to be part of the rubric. And the five dimensions that contribute to a school's success are school indicators, and I'll talk a little bit about each one of these, but school indicators, student outcomes, leadership, support, and programmatic and instructional practices. Now, for each of these dimensions, what we also included in the rubric were specific educational equity goals that you know quite well, Bradley, because you developed them as part of IDRA's Equity Assistance Center. And the five goals that are embedded in these indicators include a comparably high academic achievement and other student outcomes, equitable access and inclusion, equitable treatment, an equitable opportunity to learn, and equitable resources. So when a person gets our rubric, and by the way, they can find our rubric at our website over at www.idra.org, and our Good Schools rubric, within each of the dimensions, say for example, school indicators, what should you look for in a school that will tell you whether children are achieving or not? Well, as far as school indicators, you would look at some student output or outcomes that include retention rate, dropout rate, enrollment in gifted and talented. We should not see, for example, an underrepresentation of ELLs in gifted and talented and an overrepresentation of ELLs in special education programs, as an example. Enrollment in special education or remedial programs that I mentioned, test exemption rates, and program exiting standards. Within another dimension of student outcomes, you should be looking at oral language proficiency, reading and writing proficiency, content area mastery in English, and content area mastery in the native language.
Also, Josie, you are suggesting then that you don't need to first learn English and then content, but you can learn English while you're engaged in content. Is
Absolutely.
That correct?
Absolutely.
That's a very
Absolutely.
Important point.
At the school level, what should you be looking at? Well, leadership is huge. We found that to be hugely important. And within leadership, the leadership school level indicator, you've got to be looking at your vision and goals within the school, your school climate, linkages, school organization, and accountability. At the school level, also looking at support. Within that dimension, you've got to look at your professional development.
Absolutely.
Parent involvement or family involvement, teacher accountability and student assessment, staff selection and how do you recognize staff, community involvement. And finally, at the classroom level, looking at the programmatic and instructional practices, you should be seeing whether you are using an appropriate program model. Is it research-based or not? Positive classroom climate, an academically challenging curriculum, high expectations that teachers and administrators have for children. And how is the program articulated within the school? As you can see, there are a number of criteria, but within each criterion, there are specific examples and there are standards that emerged from the data. So, for example, one of the things that we saw in leadership, and this was in a reservation school in Utah, I'm quoting one of the teachers there. Mm-hmm. The bilingual program that we have at the school has helped generate more interest in the Navajo language and culture. Finally, in the 1980s, there was a greater interest because people began to see that the language was being lost and so was the culture. We have a program that has become a model for the reservation. In that particular example, that school was a school that had few resources. But what it lacked in resources, it more than made up with in the commitment and the dedication and the competencies and skills of the adults working in the school. The commitment was such that the school day extended, sometimes till 7 o'clock at night. The inclusion of families was quite present, not as families who would come in and perhaps, you know, do teacher aid type of stuff, but as families who were decision makers, who knew their children better than anybody, and who could work with teachers to make sure that the children achieved. In another school in Oregon, there was the private sector involvement where, and that was part of the community involvement, where the businesses would work with the schools to make sure that their employees who were parents or grandparents of the children, they would coordinate their work schedule with the school schedule so that the businesses could make sure that the families and the parents could get to school meetings, could be involved in the school without having to sacrifice the work schedule that they have. So there was that type of coordination
sure, sure.
That occurred. One of the other things about school climate that was of interest to us, school safety was important at all of the schools. That was something that folks kept telling us. Children and their families needed to feel safe at school. But there was something else that emerged from the research, and that was that teachers also needed to feel safe, but not in the way we normally think of safety. Teachers needed to feel safe to try new things, to innovate and to create and to speak their minds. Quite often, teachers would come up with some great ideas, and they needed to feel there was not only a safe place to get input and feedback from their principals and from other teachers, but there was also a structure. So there was a regular Friday meeting, for example, where what we know now as, or we talk about now as a learning community, essentially that was it. There was a learning community that teachers and the principal would establish, and once a week they would come together and look at student assessment in a diagnostic way, looking at what is it that children needed to achieve, and would redirect, adapt their instructional practice to make sure that children were learning and other teachers were learning from what the other teachers were doing. So it was that kind of not only vertical but horizontal alignment that was also occurring. One of the teachers, I remember, would tell us that she knew that she had to make sure that her children were ready for the next grade. In this case, it was a fifth grade. Because if any of her children did not succeed in fifth grade, the fifth grade teacher was going to come back and talk to her about what happened.
Why
didn't you make sure these children were succeeding? And it was that type of accountability that teachers felt very strongly that was really critical to that school's success.
Josie, I could just listen to this forever. I know our time has pretty much run its course. But this last point of people being accountable to one another in terms of children's success is one of the reasons why I did add that sixth goal to the original five goals of equity, the last being accountable, that we are talking about creating accountable schools and where people are accountable to and for one another in support of children's success in schools. Can't thank you enough, Josie, for this very, very quick overview of the Good Schools publication, the research that came together in order to create the wonderful publication that many, many people around the country are using and have used in order to look at the quality of schooling for children whose first language is not English and how we move them to a competent use of English. We could talk about this forever. I think I need to have you back to finish talking about some of the other areas of the Good Schools rubric, but I just want to go on record as thanking you for having spent some time making us familiar with the document, familiar with the research that went behind it, and also to reacquaint us with the importance of high-quality bilingual educations as a good foundation, a necessary foundation for moving English language learners into a competent use of English in public schools, which helps to ensure their success in elementary and beyond. One closing question, Josie, and it is, if a reader wanted to begin the process of looking at the quality of schooling for English language learners, what one thing in closing would you suggest?
I think one thing that they would need to look at in the final analysis of all of this is to understand and to believe and to practice that native language and culture, when it is embedded and woven into curriculum and instruction, results in students' culture and family being validated, in self-esteem being improved, and in their academic achievement increasing. And the way you can do that best right now is get our good schools. Look at that rubric, look at those standards, look at what you are doing in your school, and call on IDRA to come in and help you with the technical assistance that you may need. The other is, if you would like to read the research study itself, it was published in the Bilingual Research Journal as well as our IDRA newsletters, and so you're very welcome to do that. But if there's one thing at the end that I would want to leave people with, is know that IDRA is here to stand with you and to work with you, to help you make sure that all your children do achieve in school, please call on us. We're happy to help and bring our expertise and our commitment and our passion with us to help you.
And with that note, I want to thank you, Josie, once again for taking time out to be with us. I want to thank our readers once again for being with us. And I would, in closing, invite you to go to our website, to certainly visit our website or iTunes in order to pick up the podcast series. Please spend a moment filling out the survey. We certainly would want to hear from you. And remember to take care of yourselves until the next time that we meet. I am Dr. Bradley Scott signing off and thanking you once again for having visited with us today. Thanking Josie, Danini Cortez for sharing information about the good schools for children learning English, and to remind you to take care.
Thank you for listening to IDRA Class Notes. For more information on IDRA and other Class Notes topics, go to www.idra.org. You can also send us your thoughts by email to podcast@idra.org or fill out the form on our podcast webpage at www.idra.org/podcasts.